On Religious Establishments, a sermon preached in St. George's Church, Edinburgh, before the Society for the Daughters of the Clergy in May 1829, by Thomas Chalmers. On Religious Establishments, 2 Timothy 2, verse 2, "And the things that thou hast heard of me among many witnesses, the same commit thou to faithful men, who shall be able to teach others also." The apostle, by this verse, makes provision for the continuance of a gospel ministry upon earth. If he do not enact the mode of succession for all ages, he at least exemplifies it from his own age down to a third generation of Christian teachers in the church. He ordained Timothy to this office, who is also to ordain others, which last, we may well conjecture, were not only to minister, but in their turn to ordain ministers who might come after them. It must be acknowledged, however, that there is marvelously little of express enactment in Scripture for an ecclesiastical constitution, and that this fertile controversy chiefly turns upon apostolical example and the lights of ecclesiastical history, thus leaving it more in the shape of an indeterminate or discretionary question, and to be decided by considerations of expediency, a term which, in the Christian sense of the word, is of far loftier bearing than in the vulgar sense of it, as pointing not to what makes most for the good of self or the good of society, but as pointing to what makes most for the prosperity of religion in the world, for the extension and the glory of our Redeemer's kingdom. Expediency, wherewith we commonly associate a certain character of sordidness, instantly acquires a sacredness of character when its objects are thus made sacred. And its high aim is more thoroughly to Christianize a land and to ensure a fuller and more frequent circulation of the gospel among its families. Now, there is one question of ecclesiastical polity, which in the lack of aught in the New Testament that is very distinct or authoritative upon the subject, we should feel much inclined to decide upon this ground. We mean the question of a religious establishment. The truth is that Christianity for three centuries was left to find its own way in the world, for during the whole of that period, none of this world's princes did it reverence. All this time it was treated as an unprotected outcast, or rather as a branded criminal. Yet the execrable superstition, as it was then called, neither withered under neglect, nor was quelled by the hand of persecuting violence. It grew and gathered into strength under the terrible processes that were devised for its annihilation. Disgrace could not overbear it. Threats could not terrify it. Imprisonment could not stifle it. Exile could not rid the world of it or chase the nuisance away. The fires of bloody martyrdom could not extinguish it. They could not all prevail against a religion which had the blessing of heaven upon its head and in its bosom the silent energies of conviction. And so it spread and multiplied among men. And signal triumph of principle over power, of the moral over the sentient and the grossly physical, was the indestructible church nurtured into might and magnitude and settled more firmly on its basis amid the various elements which had conspired for its overthrow. Throughout the whole transition, from the time that the fishermen of Galilee tended its infancy, to the time that the emperors of Rome did homage to its wonderful manhood, it had neither the honors nor the revenues of an establishment. This change did not, and could not, originate with the ecclesiastical. It originated with the civil authority. It took effect by the state holding out to the church the right hand of fellowship. The advance was made by the former, and we should hold it tantamount to the vindication of a religious establishment, could we demonstrate how, without the compromise of principle, but rather in obedience to its purest and highest behests, the advance might be met and consented to by the latter. Let me suppose, then, a society of Christians, great or small, actuated, as Moravians now are, by the spirit and the zeal of devoted missionaries, pressed in conscience by the obligation of our Savior's last saying, "Go and preach the gospel to every creature," bent on an expedition to the heathen of distant lands, if they had but an opening for the voyage and the means of defraying it. Hitherto, it will be admitted, that all is purely apostolical, and that, as yet, no violence has been done to the high and heaven-born sanctities of the gospel. Now what we ask is, whether there be aught to vitiate this holy character in the next indispensable step of the means being provided, of money being raised for the essential hire and maintenance of the laborers, of the vessel being equipped that is to bear them onward in this errand of piety, of the wealth being transferred to their hands from the hands of willing contributors, for the support of the missionary household, for the erection of the missionary church and missionary dwelling places. Is there aught of earthly contamination in this? Is the unitas fratrum, that church of spiritual men, at all brought down from its saintliness by those annual supplies, without which their perils among the heathen could not have been encountered, their deeds of Christian heroism could not have been performed? They maintain their own independence as a church notwithstanding. Their doctrines and discipline and mode of worship are left untouched by the proceeding. In all matters ecclesiastical, they take their own way. It is true they are subsisted by others, but in no one article relating to the church's peculiar business are they controlled by them. They are maintained from without, but they need not, because of this, suffer one taint of desecration within. There is a connection, no doubt, established between two parties, but I can see nothing in it save a pecuniary succor rendered upon the one side and a high service of philanthropy rendered upon the other, yet rendered according to the strict methods and in rigid conformity with the most sacred principles of those who are embarked on this high and holy vocation. The transaction, as we now relate it, is of purest origin, and has been nobly accredited by the blessed consequences which have followed in its train. For by means of these hireling laborers, the outposts of Christianity have been pushed forward to the very outskirts of the human population. Christian villages have been reared in the farthest wilds of paganism. The prowling savages of Greenland and Labrador have been reclaimed to the habits and the decencies of civilized life. And greater far than any bliss or beauty which can be made to irradiate this fleeting pilgrimage, successive thousands of before untaught idolaters, under the effective tuition that has been brought to bear upon them, have lived in the obedience and died in the triumphs of the faith. Now, the essential character of this whole transaction is the same, whether we conceive these gospel laborers to be employed in the business of a home or in the business of a foreign mission. By the one process, you carry the lessons of our religion beyond. By the other, you circulate them within the territory of Christendom. The effect of the one is to spread Christianity externally abroad, and so perhaps as to sprinkle many nations. The effect of the other is to fill up the internal vacancies, and so perhaps as thoroughly to saturate with Christianity one nation. It is not enough reflected on that, under the latter process, a vastly greater number of human spirits may be medicated into spiritual and immortal health than under the former, and, at all events, that this latter also must have its accomplishment, ere the knowledge of the Lord shall fill the earth even as the waters, which, in their collapse, admit of no internal vacancy, cover the sea. But the position which I chiefly want to fix at present is that, whether the missionary movement be in an outward or in a homeward direction, its whole economy and character may remain essentially the same. The enterprise may be supported in its expenses by one party. It may be executed in its work and labor by another party. Each may be distinct of the other and give no disturbance to the other. The secular men may provide the means, yet the ecclesiastical men, in their proper department, may have the entire and uncontrolled management. They may take their support from others and things temporal, yet suffer no invasion by them on their inviolable prerogative of determining and ordering in things spiritual. Their maintenance cometh from others, but their worship, and their creed, and their formularies, and their sacraments, and their ministrations, both of word and of ordinances, are all their own. We yet see no compromise of principle in such a connection as this. There is support given upon the one side, but there is no surrender in the least article either of faith or holiness made upon the other side. The only submission that we can perceive on the part of these missionaries or ministers to other men is a submission to be fed by them, and that they might wait without distraction on the business of their own unshackled and uncontrolled ministry. In this instance, then, as in the former, there is the like pure origin, and there may be a like or perhaps a surpassingly glorious result. If by the foreign mission stations are planted along the margin of our peopled earth, by the home mission stations may be multiplied over the territory of our own land. If, as the effect of the one, we now behold villages of peace and piety in the distant wilderness, as the effect of the other, the moral wilderness around us may be lighted up and fertilized, and we may be made to witness both a holier Sabbath and purer weekdays than heretofore in all our parishes. If, in virtue of the missionary doings abroad, we read that hundreds of families in some before untrodden field of heathenism have been Christianized, let us not forget that many are the cities of our own island, where, without 1 mile of locomotion, we might have conversed with thousands of families which, but for the same doings at home, would be sunk in the apathy and the grossness of practical heathenism. If, as the fruit of the one service, we can appeal to humanized savages and rudest wanderers of the desert, transformed into Christian and companionable men, let not the splendor of this achievement eclipse the equal importance of the other service, if we can appeal to an effectiveness as mighty and momentous in our own cottage patriarchs, our own virtuous and well-taught peasantry. Now, we think it is not by a financial, but by a sound generalization that we pass from the case of a home mission to that of an establishment, which is neither more nor less, in fact, than a universal home mission. At its first institution, in the days of Constantine, the very work remained to be done which we have now specified. Its proper object is not to extend Christianity into ulterior spaces, but thoroughly to fill up the space that had been already occupied. It is a far mightier achievement than may appear at first view, completely to overtake the whole length and breadth of a land. All the itineracies and the traverse movements of the many thousand missionaries who during the 3 first centuries lived and died in the cause fell short of this accomplishment. They did much in the work of spreading the gospel externally, but they left much undone in the work of spreading it internally. They had Christianized the thousands who lived in cities, but the millions of pagans or of peasantry who were yet unconverted, evinced the country to have been everywhere a great moral fastness, which, till opened up by an establishment, would remain impregnable. Now, this very opening was presented to the ministers of Christ when the Roman Emperor, whether by a movement of faith or a movement of philanthropy and patriotism, made territorial distribution of these over his kingdoms and provinces, and, assigning a territorial revenue for the laborers of this extensive vineyard, enabled each to set himself down in his own little vicinity, the families of which he could assemble to the exercises of Christian piety on the Sabbath, and among whom he could expatiate through the week in all the offices and attentions of Christian kindness. Such an offer, whether Christianly or but politically made upon the one side, could most Christianly be accepted and rejoiced in by the other. It extended inconceivably the powers and the opportunities of usefulness. It brought the gospel of Jesus Christ into contact with myriads more of imperishable spirits, and with as holy a fervor as ever gladdened the heart of the devoted missionary, when the means of an ampler service to the Redeemer's cause were put into his hands, might the Church in these days have raised to heaven its orisons of purest gratitude, that kings at length had become its nursing fathers and opened up to it the plenteous harvest of all their population. There is just as little of the essentially corrupt in this connection between the Church and the State as there is in the connection between a missionary board and its pecuniary supporters. Each is a case of the earth helping the woman. But whatever of earthliness may be upon the one side, there might be none, and there needs be none, upon the other. The one may assist in things temporal, while the other may continue to assert its untouched and entire jurisdiction as heretofore in things spiritual. There might thus be an alliance between the altar and the throne, yet without the feculence of any earthly intermixture being at all engendered by it. The state avails itself of the Church's services, and the Church gives back again no other than the purest services of the sanctuary. Its single aim, as heretofore, is the preparation of citizens for heaven. But, in virtue of the blessings which Christianity scatters on its way, do the princes of this world find that these are the best citizens of earth, and that the chief defense of nations, the best safeguard of their prosperity and their power, is a universal Christian education. There needs be naught, we repeat, of contamination in this. The state pays the Church, yet the Church, in the entire possession of all those privileges and powers which are strictly ecclesiastical, maintains the integrity of her faith and worship notwithstanding. She might be the same hallowed Church as when the fires of martyrdom were blazing around her, the same spirituality among her ministers, the same lofty independence in all her pulpits. The effect of an establishment is not necessarily to corrupt Christianity, but to extend it. Not necessarily to vitiate the ministrations of the gospel, but certainly to disseminate those ministrations more intimately amongst, as well as to bear them more diffusively abroad over the families of the land. But just as in philosophy and politics, there are mistakes upon this subject of a religious establishment, from the very common error of not assigning the right effect to the right cause. There is a kind of vague and general imagination, as if corruption were the invariable accompaniment of such an alliance between the civil and the ecclesiastical. And this has been greatly fostered by the tremendously corrupt popery, which followed in historical succession after the establishment of Christianity in the days of Constantine, and which certainly holds out, in vivid contrast, the difference between this religion in the period of its suffering and this religion in the period of its security and triumph. but it were well to discriminate the precise origin of this frightful degeneracy. It arose not from without, it arose from within. It was not because of any ascendancy by the state over the church, whom it now paid and thereby trenched upon its independence and things spiritual. It was because of an ascendancy by the church over the state. The effect of that superstitious terror which it wielded over the imaginations of men, and which it most unworthily prostituted to the usurpation of power and things temporal. The fear that many have of an establishment is, lest through it the state should obtain too great power over the church, and so be able to graft its own secularity, or its own spirit of worldliness, on the pure system of the gospel. Whereas the actual mischief of popery lay in the church having obtained too great power over the state, and in the false doctrines which it devised to strengthen and perpetuate a temporal dominion which should never have been permitted to it. There is no analogy between the apprehended evils to Christianity from an establishment nowadays and the actual evils inflicted on Christianity by the corrupt and audacious hierarchy of Rome. The thing dreaded from that connection between the church and state, which an establishment implies, is lest the state, stepping beyond its own legitimate province, should make invasion upon the church, and so, by a heterogeneous ingredient from without, in some way adulterate the faith. The thing experienced, on the contrary, was that the church, stepping beyond its legitimate province, made an invasion upon the state, and all the adulteration practiced, either on the worship or the lessons of Christianity, was gendered from within. So far from the state having too much power so that it could make unlawful invasion on the church, it had too little power, so that it could not resist the unlawful invasion made by the church upon itself. The theoretical fear is, lest the state should meddle with the prerogatives of the church. The historical fact is that the church meddled with the prerogative of the state. So far from the apprehended corruption having experience to rest upon, it is precisely the reverse of the actual corruption. But the truth is that after many conflicts, the matter is now better understood, and the understanding is that neither should meddle with the prerogatives of the other. The state may pay the church, yet without conceding to it one particle of temporal sovereignty. The church may serve the state, yet without the surrender of one spiritual prerogative. To teach the people Christianity, that is the church's service. To teach them no other than that what itself judges to be the Christianity of the Bible, that is the church's prerogative. To deal out among our parish families the lessons of faith and of holiness, this is the church's incumbent duty. But that these shall be no other than what itself judges to be the very lessons of that Scripture whose guidance in things spiritual it exclusively follows, and that in this judgment no power on earth shall control it, this is the Church's inviolable privilege. The state might maintain a scholastic establishment, but without charging itself with the methods of ordinary education, leave these to the teachers. Or the state might maintain an ecclesiastical establishment, but without charging itself with the methods of Christian education, leave these to the church. In both cases, it would multiply and extend over the land the amount of instruction. Yet, the kind of instruction it might leave to other authorities, to other boards of management than its own, and this were the way to secure the best scholarship and the best Christianity. For the sake of an abundant gospel dispensation, we are upheld in things temporal by the state. For the sake of a pure gospel dispensation, we are left in things spiritual to ourselves. And on ourselves alone does it depend whether the church now might not be the same saintly and unsullied church that it was in the days of martyrdom, as spiritual in its creed, as purely apostolic in its spirit, as holy in all its services. We will not allege the infallibility of our own church, for this were popery, though in the dress of Protestantism. We will not contend for the wisdom and the rectitude of all its doings, for we hold that there is neither individual nor corporate perfection upon the earth. But let the distinction be made between the acts of an establishment and the powers of an establishment. And we know not if, through the whole of Christendom, there be one more happily devised in any other country for the religious good of its population. The fitness of a machine is one thing, the working of it is another. We feel as if it were no more than a warrantable confidence when we stand up for the former, though we should feel it a most tremendous presumption did we in every instance and upon all occasions stand up for the latter. In regard to the fitness of the mechanism, it may be the best possible. In regard to the actual working of the mechanism, one would need to side with all the majorities which have occurred for two centuries, and under all the changes of ecclesiastical policy, ere he could conscientiously affirm that it has at all times been the best possible. Still, amid all the imputations and the errors which its greatest enemies may have laid to its door, we hold that upon the alternative of its existence or non-existence, there would hang a most fearful odds to the Christianity of Scotland. Let us admit it is true that the apparatus might be made greatly more effective. Still, it is true that a deadly effect would follow and be felt to our remotest parishes were the apparatus taken down. It were tantamount to a moral blight over the length and breadth of our land. And though we have not time to demonstrate what now we have only time to affirm, yet with all the certainty of experimental demonstration we say it, that the ministrations of our church then done away would never be replaced to within a tenth of their efficacy by all the zeal and energy and talent of private adventurers. There would arise no compensation for the present regular supply. There would arise no compensation for its fullness. Instead of the frequent parish church, that most beauteous of all spectacles to a truly Scottish heart, because to him the richest in moral association, and to whom therefore its belfry, peeping forth from among the thick verdure of the trees which embosom it, is the sweetest and the fairest object in the landscape. Instead of this, we should behold the bare and thinly scattered meeting houses. For the large intervening spaces, we should have nothing but precarious and transient itineracies to trust to. The well-established habit of Sabbath attendance, now as constant with many of our families as the weekly recurrence of the parish bell, would necessarily disappear. In a moral sense, they would become the waste and howling wildernesses of Scotland. We feel quite assured that under this withering deprivation, a hard and outlandish aspect would gather on the face of our people. The cities might be somewhat served as heretofore, but the innumerable hamlets would be forsaken. And just as it was anterior to an establishment at all, our peasants would again become pagans, or under the name and the naked ritual of Christianity, would sink into the blindness and the brutality and the sad alienation of paganism. But, without enlarging on this consideration, in which, however, there lies much of the strength of our cause, let us briefly recur to the leading argument of the day. It is not true that corruption must adhere in virtue of its very nature and as by necessity to an establishment. There will be corruption, in fact, but rightly to estimate the quarter it comes from, distinction should be made between the nature of the institution and the nature of man. In virtue of the former, there may be no contamination, while in virtue of the latter, there may be a great deal. An establishment may, in this case, be the occasional but not the efficient cause of mischief. The machine may be faultless, but exposed, as it must be while the species lasts, to the intromission of hands which to a certain degree will taint and vitiate all that they come in contact with. The remedy is not to demolish the machine and transfer the hands which wrought it to other managements and other modes of operation. There will still be corruption notwithstanding. It will prove a vain attempt at escape if you think to make it good by transferring human nature from the economy of an establishment to the economy of any of our sectaries. The human nature which you thus transfer will carry its own virus along with it. And while that nature remains, there will be corruption in both, and which is strictly chargeable neither on the one economy nor on the other. It follows not, therefore, because of this one or that other abuse, that the framework of our establishment should be destroyed. To make head against an abuse, we should direct our efforts to the place where the abuse originated. Not to the machinery, therefore, in the present instance, but to the men who work the machinery. It is not to a constitutional or political change in any of our establishments that we should look for the coming regeneration of our land. It is to a moral and spiritual change in those who administer them. It is there, and not in the framework, where the change and the correction ought to be made. This is the way by which to get rid of corruption, and not by putting forth upon our national institutions the innovating hand of a destroyer. There is corruption in the civil government of our empire, yet that is no reason why it should be brought to dissolution. There is corruption in the municipal government of our towns, yet what fearful anarchy would ensue should that be made the pretext for another overthrow. And every populous community in our land were left without a presiding magistracy to check and to control them. There is corruption, we will say it, in every family government throughout the nation. Yet who can tell the numerous ills that would fester in every household and flow over in innumerable streams upon society, were the rights and the restraints of parental authority therefore put an end to? And there may be corruption in the ecclesiastical government of our own church. This may be true, and yet it be just as true that if, either by the policy of infatuated rulers or by the frenzy of an infatuated people, this church were swept away, it would inflict a most deleterious blow on the character of Scotland and the Christianity of Scotland's families. It is not by the violence of public hostility against our church that the nation is to be reformed. It is rather by the control of the public opinion upon her ministers, and most of all, by the answer from heaven to the people's prayers that her priests may be clothed with salvation. Were the establishment, and that too under the pretext of its corruption, destroyed, this would do nothing, and worse than nothing. Were the establishment, either in the whole or in certain parts of its constitution reformed, this of itself would do little, and so little as to stamp insignificance on many a contest of ecclesiastical policy. Were the establishment to have the Spirit of God poured forth upon its clergy, then with the multiplication of its churches and parishes, made more commensurate to the wants of our increasing population, this and this alone would do everything. A conscientious minister, even with the establishment precisely as it is, has within its borders the liberty and the privilege of unbounded usefulness. He has scope and outlet there for the largest desires of Christian philanthropy. He has a parish within which he might multiply his assiduities at pleasure, and with no other control but of the word of God over his doctrines and his services and his prayers. Should he quarrel with the reigning policy of our church, he has a place for the utterance of his testimony against all he might esteem to be its defections and its errors. He can give his eloquence and his vote to the strength of its minorities. He can, by the contribution of his own name and of his own proclaimed or recorded opinion, add to the moral force which always lies in an opposition of principle and which numbers cannot overbear. All this he may do, and without forfeiting the respect, nay, even the kindness of his adversaries. But to go back from the courts of our establishment to its parishes, where after all he is on his best vantage ground for the services of Christian patriotism, he can there expatiate without restraint in all the deeds and the devices of highest usefulness. It is on this precarious homewalk of piety and peace that he can acquit himself of his noblest ministrations for the interests of our immortal nature and the good of human society. It is there where he sheds the purest influences around him, whether by the holiness of his pulpit or the kindness of his household ministrations. I cannot imagine a stronger yet happier ascendant than that which belongs to a parish minister, who, throned in the cordialities of his people, finds unbounded welcome at every cottage door, and by his unwearied attention at sicknesses and deaths and funerals, has implicated the very sound of his name and idea of his person with the dearest interests of families. We positively know not if anywhere else than under this mild patriarchal economy a scene of so much moral loveliness can be found, or one where the hopes of heaven and the best and kindest affections of earth are so beautifully blended to uphold a system which covers all the land with so bland and benignant an economy as this may well be termed the cheap defense of the nation. To uproot it is the Gothic imagination of certain unfeeling calculators, whose sole principle in the science of their politics is a heartless arithmetic, but who, in the midst of their plodding computations, have overlooked what that is which constitutes the chief element of a nation's prosperity and a nation's greatness. It is our part to vindicate the worth and importance of a church establishment to society, and this is best done by the worth and importance of our services. This will form our best security, infinitely better than any which statesmen can devise. There were certain recent alarms in which I could not participate, because I felt that any apprehended danger from without might be greatly more than counteracted by a moral defense from within. This is the reaction by which we have hitherto stood our ground, against infidelity on the one hand and sectarianism on the other, and with such an effect that, with enough of energy and conscientiousness and enlightened zeal on the part of her ministers, all the menaces and agitation by which we are surrounded will only rivet the Church of Scotland more firmly upon her basis, and rally more closely around her cause the wise and the good of our nation. In regard to an establishment, it makes all the difference in the world to a conscientious man whether it exposes the church to the evil of an overbearing constraint from without, or, in common with every other Christian society, to the evil of a spontaneous corruption from within its own bosom. If not to the former, he may carry entire into the establishment all his powers and his liberty of usefulness. If only to the latter, he may personally have no share in the corruption, and politically, if such be the constitution of the church that he is vested with the privilege, he may resist, and if overcome, may lift his testimony against it. In all these respects, we know of nothing more perfect than the constitution of the Church of Scotland. There is, to each of its members, an independent voice from within, and from without, there is no force or authority whatever in matters ecclesiastical. They who feel dislike to an establishment do so in general because of their recoil from all contact and communication with the state. We have no other communication with the state than that of being maintained by it, after which we are left to regulate the proceedings of our great home mission with all the purity and the piety and the independence of any missionary board. We are exposed to nothing from without which can violate the sanctity of the apostolical character if ourselves do not violate it. And neither are we exposed to aught which can trench on the authority of the apostolical office if ourselves we make no surrender of it. In things ecclesiastical, we decide all. Some of these things may be done wrong, but still they are our majorities which do it. They are not, they cannot, be forced upon us from without. We own no head of the church but the Lord Jesus Christ. Whatever is done ecclesiastically is done by our ministers, acting in His name, and in professed submission to His authority. Implicated as the church and the state are imagined to be, they are not so implicated as that, without the concurrence of the ecclesiastical courts, a full and final effect can be given to any proceeding by which the good of Christianity and the religion of our people may be affected. There is not a clerical appointment which can take place in any of our parishes till we have sustained it. Even the law of patronage, right or wrong, is in force not by the power of the state, but by the permission of the church. And with all its fancied omnipotence, has no other basis than that of our majorities to rest upon. It should never be forgotten that in things ecclesiastical, the highest power of our church is amenable to no higher power on earth for its decisions. It can exclude, it can deprive, it can depose at pleasure. External force might make an obnoxious individual the holder of a benefice, but there is no external force in these realms that could make him a minister of the Church of Scotland. There is not one thing which the state can do to our independent and indestructible church but strip her of her temporalities. Nec tamen consumebatur. She would remain a church notwithstanding, stronger than ever, in the props of her own moral and inherent greatness, and, at least strong as ever, in the reverence of her country's population. She was as much a church in her days of suffering as in her days of outward security and triumph, when a wandering outcast, with naught but the mountain breezes to play around her, and naught but the caves of the earth to shelter her, as now when admitted to the bowers of an establishment. The magistrate might withdraw his protection, and she cease to be an establishment any longer. But in all the high matters of sacred and spiritual jurisdiction, she would be the same as before. With or without an establishment, she, in these, is the unfettered mistress of her doings. The king by himself, or by his representative, might be a looker-on, but more, the king cannot, the king dare not. But we gladly bring our argument to a close. It has been well remarked that in the abstract discussion of rights, between which there may be collision, it is difficult to avoid a certain tone of harshness, a spirit the most unlike possible to that which should be, and indeed to that which actually is in real and living exemplification. The vindication of our establishment, as far as we have proceeded in it, necessarily involves the vindication of our order from the charge, that, because supported by the state, we are therefore, as if by necessary consequence, a mean and mercenary priesthood. In repelling this, we cannot but assert the real independence which belongs to us. But let not the assertion of our independence be interpreted into an assertion of disrespect or defiance. What we say, and say truly in the abstract, may in the concrete be never realized. And for this best and most desirable of all reasons, that the one party might never be put on the hardy and resolute defense of its prerogative, just because the other party may never have the wish or the thought to invade it. There is many an ancient and venerable possession in our land whose rights are never called forth from their depository or produced in court, just because they are never trampled on. And so of the rights of our church. There might be no call for the parade or for the production of them, just because there might be no contest, and we are left to the undisturbed exercise of every power which legitimately belongs to us. It is thus that for centuries, nay, for a whole millennium, we can imagine a prosperous and a pacific union between the church on the one hand and the state upon the other, a union most fruitful in blessings to both, the church rendering to the state that most precious of all services, the rearing of a virtuous and orderly and loyal population, and the state giving tenfold extent and efficacy to the labors of the church by multiplying and upholding its stations all over the lands and providing it, in fact, with approaches to the door of every family. There is here no compromise of sound principle on the part of the church, for it is not in driveling submission to the authority of man, it is in devout submission to the high authority of heaven, that we tell our people to honor the king, to obey magistrates, to lead a quiet and peaceable life in all godliness and honesty, and meddle not with them who are given to change. Neither is there any compromise of sound policy on the part of the state, for the Christian education of the people is the high road to all the best objects of patriotism. In such an intercourse of benefits as this, there needs not, we repeat it, be so much as a taint of worldliness. We may retain entire our apostolic fervor and our apostolic simplicity notwithstanding, pure as in the season of our most dark and trying ordeals, equally pure in the sunshine of blandness and cordiality between a Christian church and an enlightened government. This audio recording was read by Michael Ives. I hope you found it enlightening and edifying. Visit my blog, westportexperiment.com, where I write about parish missions, the care of souls, and all things Reformed.